have quite a few visuals, or if you will, slides to go through. About 116 of them here, so I'm not planning on spending a whole lot of time on any individual slide. As Mike mentioned to you, you can ask questions, and if you have comments, there's ways of getting a hold of him, and there's also ways of getting a hold of me after the presentation if you need to discuss anything any further. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and start with slide number 3, which is the title slide. Radiation Safety for Environmental Professionals is part of Northam Presents. And basically what we're going to talk about are basic radiation principles. Go to slide number 4. We'll have some of the course objectives here. We want to understand some of the basic terminology and fundamental principles of radiation. Identify the 3 primary types of ionizing radiation, which is basically the type of radiation we're talking about here. There's different types of radiation. We're talking about ionizing radiation, which is pretty much the radiation that comes from what we call a radioactive decay process. And more specifically, we're going to talk about alpha radiation, beta radiation, and gamma radiation. We will discuss briefly neutron radiation, which is also ionizing radiation, but we won't talk very much about that, especially since you don't normally find that out in the environment. That's something that's usually produced. I'm going to identify some of the radiation dose limits and explain some of the methods to control that. Radiation is a hazard, as you all probably know, so we need some controls in place to make sure we don't overexpose people. So our federal government do have guidelines and actually requirements for that in the CFR's Code of Federal Regulations. And understand some of the biological effects. So we're going to move on to 5 now. The first thing we want to talk about in understanding the basic terminology and fundamentals is atomic structure. And to start off with that, go to slide number 6. Atoms. Atoms are basically, as you probably know, the fundamental building blocks of all matter. Matter is composed of chemical elements such as carbon, oxygen, lead, whatever. The smallest pieces and element can be broken down into and still retain its identity. This is important because when we start talking about radioactivity and radioactive decay, that's where it happens. It happens in the atom and probably more specifically in the nucleus of the atom. So we'll go on to slide number 7 now and start talking about some of the properties of this atom and the components of it. The models that we're using, there are several different models, believe it or not, for the atom. The model that you see depicted here is the Bohr model of the atom. And you can see we have a nucleus, which is in the center, that has protons and neutrons in it. And orbiting on the outside of the nucleus are negatively charged electrons. You can see at the bottom there for the components that neutrons have a weight. When we talk about weight, we're talking about atomic weight of 1 AMU. AMU stands for atomic mass units. It's basically based on the 12 atom. Carbon 12 has 6 protons and 6 neutrons. And each one of the protons and neutrons has a weight of 1 atomic mass unit. You can see that neutrons have no charge. They basically have a neutral charge. The protons have a positive charge, so obviously the nucleus is positively charged. And surrounding around the nucleus, again, are the electrons, which are negative charge. By the size of the electrons, you can see 0.0005 atomic mass units, so it's only a fraction of the size of the particle that would be inside the nucleus. To give you kind of an idea, a visual idea of that, if you would look at the particles in the nucleus, like the proton, the neutron, as a bowling ball, and look at the electrons as a BB, that's about a good enough comparison as far as the difference in size of these particles. Most of the mass of the atom is in the nucleus. Okay, we're going to move on. Once again, I didn't want to spend too much time on any individual slide. We'll move on to number 8. Protons positively charged. The number of protons determines the element. The have a look at your chemical chart or your periodic table of the elements, you'll notice that as the elements change, what happens is the proton number changes in them. As an example, the first element you'll probably see is hydrogen, which has one proton in it. The next one would be helium, which has two protons in it, and so on. So the main thing to get out of this also is not only is it positively charged and makes the nucleus and the atom is neutrally charged, by the way, because of the electrons offsetting the charges with the protons, but the nucleus of the atom itself is positively charged. And if you change the number of protons in an atom, you change the element of that atom to something else. We'll move on to slide number 9, which is the neutrons. Once again, has no charge, basically has a neutral charge to it. When we start talking about radioactive decay and radioactivity and atoms, nucleus transforming into other elements or lower energies, it might be a good idea to kind of look at neutrons as having both charges, a plus charge and a minus charge, and that's what makes it neutral. Because when we start talking about this decay process, we have a transformation that basically goes on in the nucleus. We can have neutrons transformed to protons, or we could have protons transformed to neutrons, all in an attempt of trying to become stable, which we'll talk about. But neutrons, once again, determines the isotope. If you change the number of protons in an element, or let's say atoms of an element, then you would change that element. If you change the number of neutrons, it's still the same element. It's just an isotope of that element for having a different number of neutrons in it. And one of the things that's important from a radiation standpoint is the number of neutrons affects the stability of the atoms. And you'll see why that's important in a second, because as atoms become unstable, they may become radioactive. The example at the bottom there, you can see hydrogen 1, which has one proton in it, and then hydrogen 2 has one proton in it. That proton number is at the bottom, by the way. And then that number at the top, which we're going to talk about in a second when we talk about the convention, is the atomic weight. That's the number of protons and neutrons that's in the atom. So you can see we can have hydrogen with one proton. You add a neutron to it, it becomes hydrogen 2, or deuteron. You add another neutron to it, it becomes hydrogen 3, or tritium. Hydrogen 1 and hydrogen 2 are stable. Hydrogen 3, which is tritium, is unstable. It's radioactive. So you can see how the neutrons can affect the stability and the radioactivity of atoms. Okay, let's move on to slide number 10. Electrons, negatively charged particles that orbit the nucleus. Generally speaking, you'll have the same number of electrons on an atom as you have protons. Try to make the atom at least electrically neutral. Try to look at we always depict these electrons as going around in like cylindrical orbits around the nucleus of the atom, but try to look at the electrons as orbiting in structured shells. Okay, and each one of these shells has a discrete energy level, and they are lettered or numbered, either lettered K through Q or numbered 1 through 7. And going to the next slide, an example of what I mean by these structured cells. You can see the nucleus in the middle, and then these shells, K, L, M, N, O, and then there's P and Q. These are the shells or the distances away from the nucleus that the electrons actually orbit in. And there's so many electrons that's allowed in each one of these shells. And without getting too complicated, the Pauli exclusion principle sets an upper limit on the amount of electrons that can actually be in one of these shells orbiting the nucleus. Okay, next slide, slide number 12. Chemical notation. This is kind of the way it looks when you look at the periodic table of the elements. At the top, the big number that you have there is the atomic number. The atomic number is the number of protons that's in an atom. You can see the chemical symbol there. The chemical symbol is usually one or two letters. The chemical name would be written out, and then the atomic weight. The atomic weight is actually the number of protons and number of neutrons within the atom itself. And while this chemical notation is fine for depicting chemical compounds, you know, such as H2O and CO2, when depicting radioisotopes, we need to show the information in somewhat of a different form. So we'll go to the next slide. And this is the normal convention that you would usually see the elements and or isotopes listed. You have A, which is the mass number or atomic weight. That number would be the number of protons and number of neutrons that's in the element, or the atom, rather. The Z number is the atomic number, which is the number of protons, usually always at the bottom. And the X is the element symbol. What you see here is the Z number is the number of protons, but you don't see what we would call the N number, the neutron number. Basically, in order to get the number of neutrons that are in the atom, you have to take the atomic number or the atomic weight and then subtract the Z number, which is the atomic number, the number of protons, and then the remainder gives you the number of neutrons that are in there. Okay, slide 14. These are typical ways that we would use this convention as far as chemical notation goes. The first one is the most common that you see. You can see an example there of carbon-12. The bottom number, once again, is the atomic number, the Z number, which is the number of protons. The top number is the atomic weight. So if you take 12 and subtract 6 from it, that would give you the number of neutrons, which is also 6. And then there's two other ways you may see that written there. Okay, we move on to the next slide. Slide 15, nuclei. Nuclei deals with the nucleus of the atom. This is a species of an atom characterized by the constitution of the nucleus, which is specified by the number of protons and neutrons and also its energy content. Nuclei are associated with radioactive decay and may be stable or unstable. There are somewhere around about maybe 1,700 nuclei that are known, of which about 300 are stable and the rest are radioactive. When we talk about radioactive atoms or elements or materials, what we're doing is we're talking about unstable atoms. Frankly put, you can have stable atoms, and when atoms get too much energy, they become unstable. And in an attempt to try to become stable, they release that energy in the form of radiation. And that radiation that we see is alpha, betas, and the gammas. Okay, we'll move on to slide 16. A radionuclei. Some people use that interchangeably with radioisotopes. Isotopes are just the same element with a different number of neutrons in it. But a radioactive nuclei is an unstable nuclei. Once again, it has too much energy. It wants to release that energy. It does that in the form of releasing ionizing radiation. Isotopes. Atoms of the same element with different number of neutrons. Same Z, different A. Slide 17. Moving on to slide 18. Some examples of isotopes. We gave you one earlier. There's some examples of carbon. We've got carbon-12. We've got carbon-13, which is stable. We've got carbon-14, which is unstable and radioactive. It's all carbon. You can see the bottom number. The atomic number is still 6, so it still has 6 protons in it. What's changing is the neutron number, and that's why the atomic weight's going up. So as we're putting more neutrons into the carbon, or the carbon is absorbing more neutrons, it's becoming too energetic, and it's becoming unstable. And when it gets to the point of carbon-14, it's actually unstable. The example at the bottom is the same with hydrogen, which we showed you before. Okay, move on to slide number 19. This thing, radioactivity, the process by which unstable atoms try to become stable, and as a result, they emit radiation. Once again, these atoms have too much energy. Radioactivity is the tendency of unstable nuclides of atoms to undergo radioactive decay. And we're going to talk about radioactive decay here in a second, which is spontaneously energy-releasing atomic transition. The example that's given here is a decay, one of the decay schemes or pathways for radium-226. It's actually said that radium has about five different alphas, and the reason they say that is they have about five different decay pathways. There can be more than one decay pathway, and when I say decay pathway, more than one way for these atoms to transform to release that energy, which they're releasing in the form of radiation. I will say that once they choose a decay pathway, it has to take that decay pathway until it finishes. One of the pathways that you can see to the left where radium-226 decays to radon-222 is by alpha decay. So all the radiation coming off of that is alpha radiation. Another example of one of the pathways of 226, you can see partly it decays through alpha radiation and then partly it decays through gamma radiation. Those symbols that you see there is a symbol for at the top for alpha radiation and the symbol for gamma radiation at the bottom. We're going to talk about why these numbers change as we go on, but you can see radium-226 decays down by giving off alpha particle to radon-222. An alpha particle, in a nutshell, is two protons and two neutrons. It's basically the nucleus of a helium atom. So every time you have an alpha decay, you're going to see the atomic weight decrease by 4, and that's why it decreased from 226 to 222. Because those four particles, two protons and two neutrons, are being emitted from the nucleus, and that is where your alpha radiation comes from. Okay, slide number 20. Radiation is energy emitted in the form of electromagnetic waves, such as the gamma radiation, or energetic particles, such as alpha radiation or beta radiation. We're going to talk about the characteristics of the radiation in the second part of this lecture. Okay, moving on to slide 21, radioactive decay. This is the process by which atoms change or decay, transform to atoms of a different element or to a lower energy state of the same element by spontaneous emission of charged particles or electromagnetic waves. Where the alpha, beta, and gamma radiation comes from. It comes from the radioactive decay process, and we call it ionizing radiation. One, because it comes from that process, and two, because it has enough energy carrying with it to ionize matter that it happens to come in contact with. In other words, ionize other atoms, stripping electrons away. Okay, slide 22. Some of the causes of radioactive decay. An unstable proton-neutron ratio. You have too many protons, too many neutrons, or neutrons, too few protons in the atom, that atom can actually become unstable because it's not balanced enough. And then we have excess binding energy within that atom. You may be saying to yourself right now, well, the nucleus of the atom is positively charged with all the protons. How come electrically, since the protons are positively charged, they don't repel each other and just spread all over the place? Well, that's part of the purpose of the neutrons that's in the nucleus. The neutrons, you can kind of look at as a nuclear glue, if you will, helping to keep that together. It's part of the binding energy of the nucleus itself. Okay. One of the examples here, this unstable proton-neutron ratio, if you move to slide 23, you'll see what's called the line of stability. On the left side of the axis, you can see neutron number, and then the bottom, proton number. You can see as the number of protons increase in the atoms, in the nucleus of the atoms actually need more neutrons in there to help keep that atom together, so to speak. Like I said, the neutrons kind of like the glue of the atom. So that you can see the line of stability there is not linear once you get up to a certain point. OK, Okay, we'll go on to slide 24. One of the main things you get out of this is protons determine what the element is. Neutrons primarily affect the stability of those atoms and can make them radioactive. Okay, slide 24, just an example of radioactive decay there. We have the nucleus transforming because it has too much energy. It's trying to release some of that energy. It goes through this process of radioactive decay. You see four particles coming out of this atom. That would be alpha radiation, two protons, two neutrons. The nucleus actually takes a piece of itself and throws it away from the atom. Okay. What you see to the right side there, that little wavy arrow there, is an example of gamma radiation. Gamma radiation is kind of a byproduct or side effect of the radioactive decay process. None of the atoms decay through gamma radiation. In order for something to decay, something has to be there. So it's pretty much a particulate decay. So all of these atoms are going to actually decay through alpha or beta decay by taking a piece of itself and transforming and throwing it out there in the environment. The atom is then left in somewhat of an excited state, trying to release some of that excess energy. It releases that energy in the form of gamma radiation. Okay? So when we talk about gamma radiation, the origin of gamma radiation, even though it's electromagnetic and very, very, very similar to X-ray radiation, the origin of gamma radiation is from the radioactive decay process, and that's why we term it gamma radiation. Okay, we'll move on to slide 25. There's different types of radioactivity in the environment. We have man-made, we have induced artifice, and we have natural radioactivity. In other words, radiation is all around us. There's naturally occurring radionuclides in the air, the cosmic, the earth, the soil, in our bodies, and pretty much just about everything we see, you know, everything that we know of. One of the primary differences is that, you know, people are radioactive. There's radioactive potassium, carbon-14 in your bodies. The thing is, the levels are so low that our conventional instruments are not sensitive enough to actually detect the radiation coming off of our body, or even the lower radiations that may be occurring naturally in the environment. Once they get up to a certain level, meaning a minimum detectable activity of the instruments, depending on the sensitivity, then we can start to see the radiation or measure the radiation. But as you can see, it's naturally occurring, and pretty much that's where our what we call our background radiation comes from. There's background radiation all around us. It's always been here, and it always will be here. Mostly comes from cosmic sources and terrestrial sources from the Earth. Okay, next slide, 26. Artificial induced radioactivity. Radioactivity produced in stable substance, stable elements, atom, by particle bombardment or electromagnetic irradiation of elements. This is also called activation. In other words, we can make some things radioactive. And then some things naturally and spontaneously decay into radioactive elements. But in this example, we have cobalt-59, which is stable. Neutron bombardment, add a neutron to it, makes it cobalt-60. Cobalt-60 is radioactive. It is a primary gamma emitter. Like I said before, though, none of the atoms decay through gamma. Cobalt-60 actually decays through beta radiation, but the primary radiation coming off of that is the gamma radiation, and that's what's significant, and that's why we call cobalt-60 a gamma emitter. It's the same thing with cesium-137. It's also a gamma emitter, but it decays through beta. So, having said that, there are very few pure source emitters, radiation source emitters. Okay, slide 27. When we talk about radiation and radioactive atoms, basically these atoms are making up material that we call radioactive material. Well, the way that we measure radioactive material is we measure it by coming up and trying to determine what the activity of the material is. So the measure of radioactive material is measured by counting the number of disintegrations, transformations, decays per unit of time. That's how we quantify how much material is there. I mean, it may be spread over a 5-square-foot area or a 50-square-foot area, but when we measure it itself and come up with the activity about, you know, what is the unit of measure for that radioactive material itself, how much of it is there, we do that by counting it from disintegrations per unit of time. That's usually disintegrations per second or disintegrations per minute. And that's also how we normally document that. And some of you may be thinking, well, gee, I have a contamination survey instrument, and it reads out in counts per minute, not disintegrations per minute, or DPM. Well, you can convert that for legal purposes. And the simple way of telling you to convert that is dividing your counts per minute by the efficiency of the instrument, and that should give you disintegrations per minute. That's the simple way of saying that. But anyway, back to the point. We measure the activity of radioactive materials by disintegrations per unit of time. Okay, next slide is 28, traditional activity units. Well, how do we record this? Traditionally, we use the curie as a measurement of activity. And you'll see the note at the bottom there. We have international symbols now that we're using. Here in the U.S., we're still, for the most part, honestly, using the traditional units. The same thing when we talk about dose rates. But there are international units that can be used, and maybe one day we'll do more of that. But the international equivalent, so to speak, of the curie is the becquerel. And at the bottom you can see one becquerel is equal to one disintegration per second. Well, look at the curie at the top, 3.7 times 10 to the 10 disintegrations per second. So one becquerel, one disintegration per second, one curie is 37 billion disintegrations per second, which is one of the reasons why we quite often use subunits. We can have millicuries, we can have, microcuries, millicuries, picocuries, nanocuries, and so on. But that's how you determine the measurement as far as the radioactive material through activity. It's usually recorded in the curie content or subunit of that, or disintegrations per unit of time, as you can see there. Okay, slide number 29. Just an example of the subunits, microcuries and picocuries. Because curie is a big number. So we quite often use subunits. Okay, we'll go to slide 30 now. All the radioactive atoms or radioactive substances have a half-life. It's the time required for a radioactive substance to lose one half of its activity due to radioactive decay. As an example, the half-life of cobalt-60, since we used it before, is 5.2 years. So basically what this is saying with the half-life is every 5.2 years, as an example for cobalt-60, it loses half of its radioactive atoms. They transform into something else. Okay? It's also said if you will let a specific radionuclide decay for 7 to 10 half-lives, it will pretty much decay down to where it's not radioactive anymore. The problem with that is with some of the long-lived radionuclides like uranium-238 versus some of the short-lived radionuclides like technetium-99. Okay? Uranium-238 has, a couple of billion-year half-life, where technetium-99 has about a six-hour half-life. So, let's go to slide number 31, and it gives you an example of a typical decay scheme. Matter of fact, the one that we have here is for uranium-238. It may be a little complicated looking at it, but you can see uranium-238, when these radioactive atoms decay, it's said to have a parent atom, and then the decay products or decay atoms are called daughters. So if you look at this, you can see uranium-238 decays at thorium-234, so thorium-234 would be a daughter or daughter product of the uranium-238. Thorium-234 decays at protactinium-234, so protactinium-234 would be a daughter to the thorium-234. The line that you see with the alphas, betas, and gammas is the typical type of radiation that comes off of that during the decay process. And the number that you see underneath the line, as the example in the first one, 5 times 10 to the 9th Y, which is years, that's the half-life. When you see Y is years, D is days, H is hours, W would be weeks, MIN would be minutes. So you can get an idea of the decay scheme there. Uranium-238 going through that whole process, trying to become stable, and when it gets down to lead-206, you can see now it's a stable isotope. The problem is it takes a long, long time for that to happen. Okay, let's move on to slide 32. Just an example that we can actually calculate the activity of certain of radionuclides. Basically, given certain information, if you know the original activity or have a measurement of the original activity of a radionuclide, we can pretty much calculate what that activity would be at some time down the road, like a year from now, 3 years from now, 10 years from now, whatever. You just need certain information to do that. And so here's the formula for you and the things that you plug into that. And you can see you got A is what we're looking for here, activity after some time. AO, the original activity, and then you can read on with the rest of that. What we're going to do now is use that formula and just give you an example where all the numbers are plugged in for you. Let's say we got a 10.5 Curie cobalt-60 radiography source, which was prepared 3 years ago. I'm on slide 33 now. Having a half-life of 5.2 years, we said cobalt-60 had a half-life of 5.2 years. What is the activity today, 3 years later? So we have certain givens there. We know what the original activity was, 10.5. We know it's 3 years elapsed in time. And that T1 half is a symbol for half-life. And you plug all that in and you go to slide 34 there. And you can see how it all works. And now 3 years later, what used to be 10.5 curies is now 7.1 curies. So that's just an example of how to calculate the activity. And slide 35, coming to the end of this particular one, we've talked about the three basic particles of the atom, the proton, the neutrons, and electrons. Chemical notation, radionuclei, which are basically atoms that are unstable, which means they're radioactive. When they're radioactive, they go through a process of trying to release that energy to become stable, and we call that process radioactive decay. We showed you a decay scheme. All of the different radionuclides have their own decay schemes. And we talked a little bit about the activity and that all of the radionuclides have a half-life, which means it loses half of its radioactive atoms in that time period. All right, now we get to the questions part from the first lecture.
Yeah, thanks, Guy. Yeah, let's go ahead and open it up if anybody on the phone lines has any questions for this first section.
Yeah, it would. For time conservation, we'll just do a brief question in the Q&A here for each one of the three different modules we're going to go through.
Yeah, I don't hear anybody chiming in. I also don't have any questions that came in over the text, so it might make sense just to move on to the next section.
We can do that. Maybe everything was presented so clearly that everybody understands everything there is to know about radiation now and atomic theory. I'm just kidding. Anyway, we'll move on to the next one. Now that we've talked about where the radiation comes from, this ionizing radiation, the alphas, the betas, the gammas, it comes from the radioactive decay process, from atoms that have too much energy and unstable trying to release that energy. Now let's talk about the characteristics of the radiation that comes from this radioactive decay process. So now we're on slide 37. We're going to talk about the types and the characteristics of ionizing radiation. Okay? And by the way, just some definitions. Ionization or ionizing, it simply means stripping electrons away from the atom. Some of you, from a chemical standpoint, may be used to a PID, a photoionization detector, or an FID, a flame ionization detector. Well, it works kind of like the same way. You know, you have it in your PID and lamp energy that has enough energy to ionize the molecules. Well, the ionizing radiation we're talking about here, alpha, betas, and gammas, have enough energy to ionize other atoms, or at least excite other atoms. And we'll talk about the difference between ionization and excitation as we move along here. So, we're on slide 38 now. We're going to talk about the four basic types of ionizing radiation. And as we go on, we're going to talk probably more about the alphas, betas, and gammas than the neutrons. But you can see them depicted here. Alpha particles, meaning they are particulate. They have a mass, okay, they have a charge. Alpha particles are the nucleus of a helium atom. It's two neutrons and two protons. So when this atom decays and take a piece of itself and throws it out there in the environment trying to lose that energy, and it throws out two protons and two neutrons from the nucleus, not only will it transform and change to another element, because you're changing the proton number, okay, it's going to reduce that atomic weight by four, as we saw in the other example in the decay scheme. Beta particles are very, very small compared to alpha particles. They're actually about the size of an electron. As a matter of fact, some people call beta particles electrons, the reason being, outside the nucleus, a beta particle has pretty much the same characteristics, properties, and behavior as an electron. Outside the nucleus, you can't tell the difference between a beta particle and an electron, except for one instance. That is, a beta particle can be ejected with a negative charge, which means it would be just like an electron outside of the nucleus, or it can be ejected with a positive charge. And we'll talk about that when we get into beta particles. A positive charge beta particle is just like an electron. However, it has an opposite charge, a positive charge, so it can't behave like a normal electron. Something else has to happen. And we'll talk about that. Gamma rays, electromagnetic radiation, is just a wave of energy, just like all the other electromagnetic radiation, your radio waves, light, your photons, your x-rays, all that is electromagnetic radiation. It has no mass and it has no charge, unlike the alpha particles and the beta particles, which do have mass and do have charge. And then there's a neutron, which is a neutral charge. Okay, slide 39. Common interactions of radiation with matter. First of all, when the radiation traverses any media, whether it's air or tissues or any other type of matter, let's look at it as an energy transfer process. The radioactive atoms decay trying to release that energy. It does that by emitting alpha and beta and gamma radiation, all of which possesses energy. So as it traverses and interacts with other matter, whether it's the table, walls, chairs, or the tissue in your body, it's losing that energy. So it's an energy transfer process. Okay? All radiation, whether it's particulate or electromagnetic, possesses energy. The reduction of that energy or the radiation's intensity as it passes through some matter is called attenuation. You probably know by definition attenuation is a lessening of something. Attenuation is a combination of two processes, absorption and scattering. Okay? Absorption usually involves the dissipation of the radiation energy into the absorbing medium, and scattering involves the deflection of the radiation from its original path, both of which deposits energy as it interacts with matter that it's coming in contact with. Okay? Now, let's talk about these two, ionization and excitation. Let's move to slide 40, and you'll see a depiction or an example of ionization. In this case, there's an alpha particle that's been emitted and is getting close to another atom, and it's ionizing the other atom. It's stripping the electron away from the atom. So that's ionization. All right. Slide number 41. In some cases, the energy departed by the radiation to the electron gives it enough energy to where it can go on and cause secondary ionizations. And that's what slide 41 depicts. Ionization caused by a particle which itself is the result of an ionization. So you can see in the left atom there how the gamma ray ionizes an electron. That electron has enough energy where it can actually ionize another atom. The energy we're talking about here is energy of motion or kinetic energy. All right? Now, what happens to this electron after it loses all of its energy? It simply becomes an orbital electron for some atom that needs electrons. Okay? So there is so-called the death of your ionized electron, your ionized particle from the atom. We're going to talk a little bit about the death of the radiation also. In other words, what eventually happens to the radiation itself when it loses all of its energy. All right? Okay, next slide, 42. Ionization, once again, the stripping of an electron. Excitation is the forced movement of an electron from an inner shell to some outer shell. Remember I said, try to look at the electron that's orbiting in shells around the nucleus in discrete energy levels. This kind of depicts that. What you see here is gamma radiation coming in, and instead of ionizing an electron, it excites it. It departs enough energy to that electron to raise it to a high energy level, or in other words, another shell within that orbit without ejecting the electron from the orbit. Well, that void space needs to be filled, so when that electron jumps back down or goes back down into its original state, it has to lose some of the energy that was departed to it that raised it to a higher state. It loses that energy in the form of an X-ray. So whenever you have ionization, you generally form X-rays also when these electrons try to jump back down into these void pockets that are left behind the excitation process. Okay? Next slide. Energy transfer process. Remember that. Linear energy transfer, the amount of energy deposited by a specific radiation over a specific distance. Alpha radiation, because of its characteristics, doesn't travel very far. It only travels an inch or two in air. So all of these ionizations or this transferring of the energy from this alpha radiation is going to happen in a very small distance. So you may have tens of thousands of ionizations in 1 centimeter of air. So alpha radiation would be considered to have a high specific ionization. Specific ionization has to do with the number of ion pairs being formed over a certain path length. An ion pair is when the atoms are ionized and the electrons are stripped away from the atom, that forms an ion pair. The stripped away electron as well as the residual atom that's left behind forms an ion pair. And now that atom that's left behind happens to be positively charged because it's missing one of the electrons that helps to keep it neutrally charged electrically. Remember, it usually had the same number of protons and electrons. Now that one of those electrons are missing, it leaves a positively charged atom behind. Okay, so once again, without getting off track, the amount of energy deposited over a specific distance. Beta travels further than alpha in air. Okay, it has more penetrating ability. It may go several feet or meters. So we may have hundreds of ionizations in a centimeter of air. So not as much energy is lost in a shorter distance as with alpha radiation, with beta. Excuse me. Gamma radiation of these three travels the furthest. For one, it has no charge. It has no mass. And so it doesn't really have anything to slow it down to interact with, for the most part. So it can travel, you know, feet, meters, or even kilometers or miles. You may have one ionization a centimeter of air. You may not have any. Okay? So, linear energy transfer is the amount of radiation energy being deposited over a specific distance as it traverses the matter that it's coming in contact with, whether that's air or whether that's body tissue. All right, slide 44. Let's talk about some of the individual characteristics of the types. Alpha radiation emitted from the nucleus, of course, that's where it comes from, the ionizing radiation from the reactive decay process. Composition, two neutrons and two protons, which we talked about, is basically, once again, the nucleus of a helium atom. It has a mass of 4 AMUs from the 4 particles, high charge of +2, which comes from the 2 protons, and typical energy ranges there at the bottom. Okay? Alpha radiation, once it loses all of its energy, and I may be getting a little ahead of myself, because it's the nucleus of a helium atom, what do you think is going to happen? The alpha radiation, those 4 particles would lose its kinetic energy by interacting. Once it's pretty much lost all of its energy, it attracts a couple of electrons and becomes a stable helium atom. So that's pretty much the death of the alpha radiation right there. And that all happens in a very, very short distance. Okay. Slide 45. Some examples of sources of alpha radiation, or alpha particles. Radioactive decay of heavier nuclei, predominantly those greater than lead or Z, which is atomic number of 82. By the way, as you start adding protons to atoms and changing to other elements, the more protons you have in there, the denser it tends to be. Okay? So those elements on the low end of the periodic table of elements, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 protons or so, are usually not very dense materials, the light materials. When you get up around 82 and you're talking about lead, or 92 where you're talking about uranium, and heavier atoms, elements, they're pretty heavy. And you probably know lead's pretty heavy. So anyway, here's an example. We've got uranium-238, decaying thorium-234, gives off an alpha particle with a typical energy range of 4.2 MeV. EV stands for electron volts. And sometimes when we're talking about a whole lot of them, we may say KeV, which is 1,000 electron volts or kilo electron volts, or MeV, which is millions of electron volts or mega electron volts. You'll also notice every time there's an alpha decay, once again, the atomic number, which is at the top, is going to decrease by 4. And the bottom number, which is if I said the atomic number at the top, I meant the atomic weight. So the top number, which is the atomic weight, decreases by 4. The bottom number, which is the atomic number, or the number of protons, also called the Z number, is going to decrease by 2. And you can see that illustrated in each one of these decays. Alright, on to 46. Path length by the engineer, high ionization per unit path length, LET, we talked about that, becomes a helium atom by attracting 2 electrons once it's lost all of its energy. So there's pretty much your alpha radiation there. I will say this, from an external standpoint, alpha radiation is not much of a hazard because it readily interacts with just about anything it hits. It even interacts with the air molecules in about an inch of air to lose pretty much all of its energy. Alpha radiation is not very penetrating at all. The dead layers of skin on your body can generally absorb the energy from the alpha radiation, which means it doesn't get into any live skin cells or any live cells in your organs in your body. So alpha radiation is not considered much of an external hazard, meaning getting the alpha radiation from an external standpoint. However, of the types, 3 primary types that we're talking about here, alpha, betas, and gammas, it is the most hazardous. It can cause the most damage. You just have to get the live cells to cause that damage, which means it's the greatest hazard if you were to inhale it or to ingest it. Okay? Okay, slide 47, just gives you an example of alpha particles ionizing electron. That alpha radiation would eventually lose its energy, attract a couple of electrons, become a stable helium atom. And the ionized electron would eventually lose its energy and become an orbital electron for some other atom that's positively charged and needs an electron. Simple as that. Okay, slide 48. Moving on to characteristics of beta particles. Now, beta particles are fairly small compared to alpha. They do have a charge, but they have more of a penetrating ability, a lot because of its smaller size. It has a longer range. It is emitted also from the nucleus, of course. Composition is identical to an electron, as we talked about. Outside of the nucleus, it acts just like an electron. We can have a negatively charged beta particle, they call that a negatron, or a positively charged beta particle. It just depends on how the nucleus transforms. It gets that name, negatron, it's just like an electron outside the nucleus, that's where the tron comes from, and then it's negatively charged, that's where the neg comes from. But the positron, you can see it's just the opposite. It's just like an electron, only it has a positive charge. So we call that a positron. Low mass, we've talked about that, typical energy ranges. It does share its decay energy with a neutrino, which means every time we have a beta decay, there's also a neutrino associated with that. But we don't care much about neutrinos because they don't pose much of a hazard at all to human beings. Okay? The next visual, which is 49, gives you an example of some beta sources. It depends on the nucleus. If the nucleus obviously has too many neutrons in it, then we have a beta minus.
Well, he's got to be there early.
Emitted from a nucleus with too many neutrons. Beta positive emitted from the nucleus with too few neutrons. Without getting too complicated, what we have inside this nucleus is this decay to transforming. Have a neutron.
It'll be light.
Formed to a proton because there's too many neutrons in there, gets rid of a part of itself, a little part of itself, of the alpha particle, a negatively charged particle, and we call that a negatively charged particle is beta radiation. Okay? If we have too few neutrons and we need neutrons, you may have a proton transform to a neutron within the nucleus. And now it has to get rid of its positive charge. It does that by taking a little piece of itself and throwing it away from the nucleus as a positively charged particle. That's a positively charged beta particle. Okay? There are some examples at the bottom. You can see hydrogen decaying down to helium, hydrogen 3, to helium by emitting a beta minus. That little sign, that V with the line over it, that's an anti-neutrino. It's always associated with beta decay. The one without the line is simply a neutrino. But you can see in one, hydrogen decay to helium. What happened here? Look at the bottom number. You have one proton and there's hydrogen. In helium, you got two protons. The atomic number at the top is the same. So when you have a beta decay, you're not losing one of the neutrons or protons in the nucleus. So the atomic number is always going to remain the same. What's going to change is you have a neutron or proton transforming in the nucleus. So that atomic number is going to change. You're either going to gain protons or lose protons. In this first situation, a neutron converted to a proton, so now we have two protons, and makes it helium-3. So there's two protons in there and one neutron. Look at potassium. Same thing happens. We have potassium 40 with 19 protons. It converts over to calcium 40. And now we've added a proton to it, so we had a neutron convert to a proton. The bottom one there, that's about 89% abundant. You can see that in the far right-hand side. About 11% of the time, we have potassium 40 decay to argon 40. In this situation, you look at the number, it lost a proton. So we had a proton convert to a neutron, got rid of its positive charge, and that's why you see a beta-positive particle being emitted there, and then the neutrino. Okay? So those are examples of beta-minus decay, the first two, and beta-positive decay, the last one. All right. beta particle interactions, we can have possible brainstrom, which is called breaking radiation. I'll talk about that briefly in a little bit. Beta radiation has a medium ionization per path length, not as energetic, so to speak, as the alpha radiation, so it has a longer path length, a little bit more penetrating ability. And positrons at the bottom produce annihilation photons. Well, remember I said that you have a negatively charged beta particle outside the nucleus. You know, once it's emitted from the nucleus, it acts just like an electron. Well, you have this positively charged beta particle out there. Now, something else is going to happen with that. Even though it's like an electron, it has an opposite charge to it. Okay? So, basically, what we have with that, with the positively charged beta particle, we know that the negatively charged beta particle, when it pretty much loses all of its energy, just like a negatively charged electron, it's going to become an orbital electron for some atom that needs electrons. Well, this positively charged beta particle, a positron, can't become an orbital electron because it's positively charged. So what happens with that most of the time, and that's why we call it annihilation radiation, you think about this. You have a positively charged particle, which is your positron. Eventually, it loses all of its energy. It attracts or gets close enough to a negatively charged electron. Well, we know that electrically, opposites attract, where like charges repel. So now we got these two opposite charged particles, but for all other practical purposes, the characteristics are the same. They get close to each other. They attract. They slam into each other, they fuse together, coalesce, and they disappear. This is where your antimatter comes from. Because they disappear, that's why we call it annihilation radiation, because that energy of mass is now converted to energy, or pure energy, in the form of a photon, or an X-ray, gamma ray, if you will, that comes off of that. So we have these two particles fuse together, disappear, and that energy is converted to pure electromagnetic energy coming off of that now. And that's why we say it produces annihilation photons. Okay. Slide 51 just depicts an example of beta particle interaction or ionization. In this case, it's a negatively charged beta particle. With alphas and beta radiation itself, when it ionizes the atoms, even though they have an electrical charge to it, that doesn't necessarily have to be an actual collision. Alpha particles are positively charged, so they're going to attract or draw electrons out of the orbit. Negatively charged beta particles can repel electrons out of the orbit. Okay, so it doesn't necessarily have to be an actual collision there. Now, moving on to the next slide, here we'll talk briefly about this brainstrom thing. Brennstrahlung is a German word for breaking radiation. Brennstrahlung, breaking, Strahlung, radiation. It's produced by the deceleration of a beta particle, normally a high-speed beta particle, around a positively charged nucleus of an atom, which is obviously positive charge because of the proton, causing X-rays to be emitted. Okay? If you look at the next slide here, 53, kind of gives you an example of the brainstrahlung radiation. And what happens here, such as with high-energy beta particles, phosphorus 32, yttrium 90, those type of emitters, interacting with high-Z material. Remember, Z is the atomic number, and the more protons, or the higher the Z number, the denser the materials. Then we're talking about high-energy beta particles interacting with things like lead, iron, and steel, high-Z material. So this interaction doesn't normally happen with the body, which is made of low atomic number stuff, things like hydrogen and carbon. This normally happens with high-energy beta particles, high-speed beta particles, and high-Z material. If you can look at the depiction, the beta particle comes in from the right. It actually slows down and bends in the electric field of the positive charged nucleus. That slowing down process is releasing some of the energy. That energy is seen in the form of an X-ray that's coming off that, which once again is pure energy or electromagnetic radiation. Okay? It's just energy transfer. The problem with brimstone radiation, just to let you know, is you can have a beta source, which actually can be shielded out fairly easy with plastics or wood, glass, thin aluminum, things like that. But if you have these high-energy beta particles, say the material that's emitting this is stored in a metal container, a dense container, you may actually be creating brimstrom, which means you're creating X-rays, which is an additional hazard to the beta radiation coming off of that. So quite often they would take high-energy beta emitters and store them in like thick-wall plastic containers to help slow the beta energies down or decrease the energy from that, and then maybe take that and store it inside of a metal container for any other of the gamma ray associated gamma radiations that may be coming off the radioactive material itself, especially if it's a mixed source. Okay, slide 54. Let's talk about gamma rays. Electromagnetic energy, pure energy, comes from the nucleus. Remember, the nucleus doesn't decay through gamma, but it's left in an excited state, and it gives off residual excess energy. That excess energy that's given off is seen as gamma radiation. So it does come from the nucleus. It's just like X-ray radiation outside the nucleus. The only real difference is its origin. Zero mass, zero charge, and then you see most common energies there. Okay, some of the sources of gamma radiation, slide 55. Nucleus rearrangements following alpha-beta decay. Remember I told you the decays, the atom is left in an excited state. Nucleus moves from excited state to a lower energy state by giving off excess energy seen as gamma radiation. And there's an example at the bottom. Remember I said that cobalt-60 decays through beta, but the primary radiation off of that is gamma. And cesium-137 decays through beta, but the primary radiation energy coming off of that is also gamma. This gives you an example of that. You get cesium-137 beta decay into barium-137. Barium-137 left in an excited state. Basically, we call that a metastable state. And while it's in that state, it gives off basically 0.662 MeV, mean electron volt, gamma radiation. Okay. Gamma radiation, moving on to 56 here. To give you an idea of this electromagnetic energy thing, here's the spectrum of electromagnetic energy. It's kind of a visual here. You have some with low frequencies, low energy, that we don't call ionizing radiation because it doesn't have enough energy to ionize the atoms. And then when we get into higher frequencies and energies, we get into the areas where we have radiation that's high enough to ionize these atoms, and we call that ionizing radiation. The next slide, 57, is just another way of looking at the spectrum. You can see the wavelength there, the frequency, and the energy. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about this is all electromagnetic energy travels at the speed of light. Okay? If you take the wavelength, and you can do this yourself if you want to right now, if you take the wavelength there and multiply it times the frequency, it all comes up to the same number, which happens to be 3 × 10⁸, and 3 × 10⁸ meters per second in a vacuum is the speed of light. Okay. You can also see in this spectrum how they kind of overlapped a little bit. But once you get up in the range there, where you've got the cosmic, it's right around in that area right there, now you're starting to get up in the higher enough energy levels to where the radiation can actually ionize atoms. Okay, slide 58. Gamma ray interactions. Very long path length, we talked about that. Low ionization, talked about that. Gamma rays can interact with matter in basically three different ways. It depends quite often on the energy of the gamma radiation and absorbing material that it's being absorbed into. In other words, how dense is it, the Z number. So, we have the photoelectric effect, the Compton scattering, some people call that Compton effect, and we have paired production. These are the three ways that gamma radiation can interact depending on the energy of the gamma again and absorbing material. Slide 59 shows the photoelectric effect. In this particular interaction, the gamma ray loses, when it interacts with an electron, it departs all of its energy to breaking that electron, all of its binding energy with that atom, and ejecting or emitting that electron away, ionizing that electron away from the atom. So all of the gamma's radiation has gone into the electron. That electron will then carry that energy and once again end up like we talked about previously. That's the photoelectric effect. In the next one, which is slide 60, we talk about Compton scattering. Here is more of a billiard ball or like shooting pool type of effect. The gamma ray comes in, it departs enough energy to eject the electron from the orbit, so you see the ionized electron there, but then the gamma ray is, the energy is reduced. It didn't use all of its energy to depart that electron. So now the gamma ray goes off at a reduced energy level, which could actually cause other ionizations. And the gamma rays itself eventually is going to lose energy and pretty much just blend in with background radiation. Okay, so that's Compton scattering. This is the one that normally happens in the human body. The first one there, which is photoelectric effect, usually happens in dense materials, in which we don't have very much of in our bodies. This is the one that usually happens predominantly in our bodies. Another one that does not normally happen in our bodies because it normally takes high energy gamma radiation. We also call that photon energy, electromagnetic. And it takes dense materials is pad production. Now, we talked about this antimatter thing a little bit ago with the beta particles, the two particles coming together and their mass being transformed to energy. Well, this is almost like the opposite effect here. First of all, in order for this interaction to occur, the gamma radiation has to have at least 1.02 MeV worth of energy in order for it to occur. If it has at least 1.02 MeV of energy, when it gets close to the nucleus of an atom, the gamma ray or the photon, the gamma photon, we use that interchangeably, disappears. And then two particles appear. An electron and a positron. Okay? Now, this is energy being transformed into mass, so to speak, in this particular situation. The reason it has to have at least 1.02 MeV worth of energy going in is because each one of those particles that appear, and they actually appear in different directions, carries 0.51 MeV worth of energy each. And if there's any excess energy, like if the gamma ray comes in at greater than 1.02 MeV, that energy is shared by the two particles as kinetic energy. Now those two particles are going to go on and behave just like an electron would when it loses its energy, which we talked about, and the same thing with the positron. Okay? Now real briefly, the neutrons emitted from the nucleus. They have a mass of 1 AMU, no charge, or basically that's their neutral charge. And then they have a range of energies. You got thermoneutrons. They get the name thermoneutrons because they've slowed down enough to where they're pretty much in thermal equilibrium with the rest of the molecules in the environment. And then we have fast neutrons. All the neutrons are pretty much fast when they're first generated. And then there's a whole range in between that we don't list here. And then when it goes down to the lowest energy level, the slowest, they become thermoneutrons. How about the sources of neutrons? We might say you don't normally find them out in the environment. It's some sort of reaction or whatever that usually has to occur in order to produce neutrons. Well, you can get it through spontaneous fission of uranium and transuranics, meaning those things greater than uranium. And pretty much all of your elements greater than uranium, which has 92 protons in it, are pretty much going to be radioactive anyway. Neutron-induced fission, operating reactors, nuclear weapons or whatever. And then you can have accelerated sources, or you can have things like neutron or radiation bombardment to create neutrons. An example here, we have alpha bombardment. We can take alpha source, let's say americium 241, and mix it with a target substance like beryllium, lithium, fluorine, things like that, and actually create neutrons. There's usually a finely divided powder of the target substance. So in this situation here, you can see the target substance is beryllium, BE9. Mix that in with an alpha emitter. There's the alpha right there. It converts, because of the two protons and two neutrons in the alpha emitter, it converts to carbon-13, left in an excited state, decays to carbon-12, which is a stable state, and gives off a neutron. Okay, so that's just one of the ways of creating neutrons here. Obviously, splitting the atom and other things are other ways to do it. Okay, slide 64, neutron interactions are almost exclusively nuclei interactions. In other words, they like to interact with the nucleus of the atom, unlike the alphas, betas, and gammas that like to interact with the electrons in the atom. So, you know, they can cause activation and excite the nucleus. Generally speaking, there's two specific types of interactions neutrons can do. They're elastic collisions and inelastic collisions. Both of them are kind of like billiards type, like shoot and pool. One of the primary differences is one of them, elastic collisions, the atom is not left in an excited state giving off a gamma ray, whereas in inelastic collisions, it is left in an excited state and also gives off an accompanying gamma ray with the neutron in action. Okay? Inelastic collision, by the way, is more socially associated with the human tissue. Okay, 65. Let's talk about some of the shielding properties of the pre-primary types and the additional one neutrons of ionizing radiation. Alpha radiation. Most alpha particles are stopped by a few centimeters of air or a sheet of paper or the dead layer of skin on your body. Alpha particles are considered an internal hazard only. If you ingest it in the inhale, they can cause great damage. The reason it does that, because it's the most energetic and ready to act with anything it hits, if you were to ingest radioactive material that was an alpha emitter, say inhaled it, and that's deposited in your lungs, all of the damage is going to happen in that small isolated area in your lungs where the material is departed. Because as the alpha radiation, as the atoms are decaying and the alpha radiation is coming off of that, and it's hitting those live tissues, the live cells in the tissues, it's being absorbed. It doesn't have a great penetrating ability. So all the damage happens in a small localized area. Whereas with the betas, radioactive material that's emitting beta or radioactive material that's emitting gamma, it spreads out a little bit more. It's more penetrating than the alpha. It doesn't readily interact as much as alpha does. And so that radiation energy is deposited over a longer path length. Remember that linear energy transfer. So there's less damage to a small isolated area and it spreads out more. Okay. Alright. So alpha is actually the most damaging if you get this out of your body. When we get into the next lecture and talk about doses and exposures, it may even come a little bit more clearer about the different types of radiation and how they actually affect your body from a biological standpoint. All right, slide 66, shielding beta radiation. Radiation can be shielded by things like plastic, aluminum, rubber, glass, safety glasses, things like that. It can't penetrate the skin and the eyes, but it doesn't have enough penetrating ability to penetrate the whole thickness of skin to get to any vital organs in your body. So it's more of an internal hazard also. However, you can get beta radiation causes an effect on your skin from an external standpoint, kind of like a beta burn or a sunburn, if you will, from the beta radiation. Okay, skin burn. All right. Gamma radiation, shielded by very dense materials, highly such as iron and lead, very penetrating, thus whole body has it. Well, the alphas and betas won't penetrate the whole thickness layer of the skin on your body to actually affect any of the vital organs in your body. Gamma radiation can. Okay, it can penetrate your body, penetrate your buddy's body standing beside you, the walls, and keep on going. Usually at a lower energy, but it does have that penetrating ability. So, gamma radiation is where we get our whole body hazard from an external standpoint. Okay, if there's a source of radiation out there and it's emitting gamma radiation and you're standing in that field, your whole body could be affected by that. Well, that would not be the case with the alpha and the beta radiation. Okay? One of the things that's probably important to remember, the radiation, remember, is an energy. Contamination actually comes from the radioactive material. Okay? The radioactive material emits energy in the form of radiation, but that radioactive material is also, if it gets on you or if it spreads or whatever, it can cause a contamination problem. But the radiation doesn't stick to you. It doesn't contaminate you. So if you're in a radiation field, you're not getting contaminated. You have to get the material on you in order to get contaminated, which is why we use PPE or protective clothing for that. You don't necessarily need protective clothing for the radiation hazard itself. What you need to do really is just monitor how much radiation exposure you have and try to keep it as low as possible. All right, shielding neutrons has a high penetrating ability. Basically, it doesn't have a charge to it, so it doesn't readily interact. It's primarily an external hazard, not normally found in the environment, and needs to be shielded by hydrogenous-type materials, which is probably the best shielding agents for the neutron radiation. Or things like graphite, something to absorb the neutrons to slow them down. And the last slide here with this particular module, which is slide 69, just gives an example of this different types of shielding material we just talked about for the alphas, betas, gammas, and neutrons, and their penetrating ability. Okie dokie. That's the end of that module. We got one more to do, but if you want to, Mike, we can take any questions from this module.
Yeah, we're running a little bit over time, I think, but I'm going to go ahead while people will take a few minutes here for questions, and while people are thinking of those questions, I did get a late question in from the first section, and we can go with that one right away. And that question is, do half-lives vary based on environmental conditions or other nearby radioactive materials?
No. All the radionuclides have their own specific half-life. And they're not affected by the environmental conditions. And the radioactivity of the substance is not affected necessarily by the environmental conditions or chemical conditions neither. You can take a radioactive substance and mix it in with some other chemicals, and that radioactive substance is still there. But to answer the question, no, it's not affected that way. Each one of them have a specific half-life. As a matter of fact, if you wanted to know more about it, you can get a hold of what they call the RAD Health Handbook, Radiological Health Handbook, and you can see a list of all the different radionuclides and what their associated half-life is.
Okay, can you say the name of that again?
Radiological Health Handbook.
I do have a few questions that came in regarding ingestion, so this is now moving on to the section you just completed.
Okay.
First question is, if alpha radiation is stopped by a few centimeters of air, practically speaking, how can you inhale it unless you have your mouth on the source?
That's a good question. Some matter is in very, very small particulate form, so you can inhale that. As a matter of fact, I don't know if the individual has ever taken an air sample, either for chemical or for radiological or whatever, but, you know, the more air that's impacted on the filter, you know, the more buildup you get, you can actually start seeing stuff on there. So anyway, my point is, you can have, let's say, radioactive contamination that becomes airborne. That may be an alpha emitter, and now all of a sudden you've got this stuff in the air, also, and you're breathing it in if you don't have a respirator on, well, yes, in that situation, let's say you will be depositing some of that radioactive material that happens to be airborne in the air that you're breathing, getting deposited inside of your lungs. And so basically what we're talking about here, we're talking about ingesting or inhaling the actual radioactive particles itself. And when we talk about this, remember the atoms are very, 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 very small. You know, we can't see these things. So the air has atoms into it. There can be radioactive materials associated with the air also that we may not be able to see or know that we're inhaling, but we can, you know, we could take an air sample and see what the concentration is and see how much of the radioactive material that we're inhaling, or even quantify and identify what the material is through sampling and analysis. Hopefully that answered the question. As far as that damage thing, the alpha from an external standpoint is shielded out by the dead layers of skin on your body, but you know, once it gets inside of your body, it's basically going to see live cells. I mean, we have cells dying all the time in our body, but you know, our body is just full of live cells, and that's where the damage is going to come from. There's no dead layer of skin to help protect the lining of your lung from the interaction with the radiation.
Okay, so if you do ingest a source, which is more harmful, a beta or an alpha emitter?
An alpha emitter is more harmful. It's more damaging than the beta emitter, and it has to do with this characteristics of readily interacting with anything. The beta radiation will cause damage, but it would cause damage over a larger area to be spread out. So not as much damage is critical to any isolated area. Well, with the alpha radiation, all the damage, all the energy is going to be absorbed by the live cells and tissues in the one small isolated area.
Okay. You know what? For the sake of time, I think we need to move on to the next section.
Okay. And if we have time in the next section, flag any more questions before 3 o'clock, we can just do that. But I'm ready if you are. Next section is modified. This is the last one. We talked about radioactive decay, which is where the radiation comes from. Now that the radiation is out there and we know it's in the form of energy, we talked about the energy transfer process, which is basically the alphas, betas, gammas interacting with other matter. Now we're going to talk a little bit about radiation dose limits and biological effects, the types of damage that it may cause to your body, and also what do we have in place to help protect people. That's where radiation dose limits comes from. We have federal guidelines or requirements, if you will, or rules or laws, because they're posted. They're basically documented in CFRs, which stands for Code of Federal Regulations. And when you talk about a code of federal regulations, you're talking about a federal law. So these are limits that are put in place to help protect people, not only the general public, but also occupational workers. Okay? So slide number 71 is the title slide for that. First thing we're going to do is slide 72. We're going to talk about the dose limits. Then we'll talk a little bit about the biological effects and where some of the sources of radiation comes from. And then we'll end this up. So, radiation dose limits. Radiation dose limits, they have recommendations that come in from organizations like the International Commission on Radiological Protection or the National Council on Radiation Protection, one being international, one being inside the United States. But they do a lot of the studies and come out with recommendations that different organizations have a tendency to adopt so that we can have some consistency. Amongst them. The little statement at the bottom, radiation exposure safe guiding principle. That thing, as low as reasonably achievable, which is pronounced ALARA or ALARA, anybody and everybody that does any work in radiation should understand that acronym. It's adopted by both of these agencies here, and basically what it says, as low as reasonably achievable, if there's something you can do to minimize your radiation exposure, thereby you're going to minimize your radiation dose, you should do it. We have administrative controls in place, Sometimes we have engineering controls in place. Sometimes we have personal protective equipment we can use and standard operating procedures and all this stuff in place to try to help minimize the amount of radiation exposure that, that an occupational worker would get or even the general public. So, let's talk about units of dose measurement. First one we're going to talk about is the Rontgen. Maybe you've heard of this guy named Wilhelm Rontgen who pretty much discovered X-rays. But it's a measure of charge produced by X or gamma radiation. That amount of charge of radiation that will produce one electrostatic unit of charge per cubic centimeter of air. So it's a measurement of charge or a measurement of energy. The key here is it only applies to X and gamma radiation. It doesn't apply to alphas or betas or neutrons. Most radiation exposure instruments, and some people call those dose rate instruments, measure in Rontgen per hour, which is hour per hour, or millirontgens per hour, or microrontgens per hour, just depending on how sensitive you want the instrument to be. EPA, which is more concerned about increases in background over the environment, chooses the most sensitive dose rate instrument, which is one that reads in micro hour per hour. Remember we talked about subunits with the Curies? Well, we've got subunits with the Rontgens and the dose rates also. Working around a radioactive site or maybe a reactor facility or something, you're probably generally going to have an instrument that reads an MR per hour. And when you're working around something that really may have high exposure limits to it, like, you know, maybe you're working on overhauling or refueling a reactor vessel or something, you'll probably have some instruments to read in the R per hour. So those are most of your dose rate instruments read it. This is what you want to use for your personal safety. When you go out to monitor for radiation, gamma radiation is generally the first one you want to monitor for. Especially in an unknown situation, and those of you that have taken the 40-hour OSHA HAZLOP course should know this. There are certain hazards out there you really can't protect yourself against, so you need to monitor for them first. If you go into an unknown situation, you should monitor for combustible gases for fire and explosion, and you should also monitor for radiation. Radiation does not give you an early warning. You can't sense it. You can't smell it. You can't taste it. You can't feel it. You can't hear it. The only way to determine its presence is with a radiation detection instrument. So you really do want a radiation instrument that reads gamma radiation when you're first approaching a suspected area to make sure that you can have something in your hand that gives you an idea of what your radiation exposure is so you can help use that information to help protect yourself and lower your overall exposure and consequently your overall dose. Okay, next slide, 75. Units of dose measurement, RAD. Well, we've got the Rontgen for X and gamma radiation. What about the effects from the other radiation? What about alphas and betas? Well, they come up with this thing with radiation absorbed dose, which is the radiation absorbed, like say in tissue, the amount of energy absorbed in the material, regardless of the type of radiation. So RAD applies to gamma radiation, alpha radiation, beta radiation, and neutrons. And you can see also, international Rontgen is still called a Rontgen. International RAD, which is the traditional unit in the U.S., is called a gray. And there's a conversion there. Okay? One RAD is 0.01 grays, which means if you have one gray, that equals 100 RADs. That's one way to look at that. The next one is REM, and looking at the bottom of that, you can see international, we call that a sievert, and it's just like a gray as far as the conversion. It takes 100 REM to equal 1 sievert. Now, a REM is radiation or Rontgen equivalent NAND. Now that we have an absorbed dose that we can measure from any type of radiation, because of the different characteristics, what is the biological damage that it's doing to your body? So that's why we come up with the measurement of the REM. It's the measure of biological risk from a dose regardless of the radiation. The unit of dose equivalent for any type of radiation that represents the equivalent of damage caused by one rad of the X or gamma radiation. Now, because we have these different characteristics, what we do and we move to the next slide here,
slide
77, we assign a quantity factor to the different types of radiation.
All right, make one.
That when multiplied by the dose of that radiation in rads, gives you the equivalent of biological damage to your body. So it's a numerical value that's multiplied by the absorbed dose, which is rad, to give you a dose equivalent. And you can see the gamma. It's all based on gamma. Gamma, the quantity factor, is 1. So 1 Rankine is 1 rad is 1 rem. Remember we talked about alpha being the most damaging. Well, look at the bottom there, and you see alpha. 1 rad of alpha, the quantity factor for alpha is 20. So 1 rad of alpha would give you equivalent biological damage of 20 rem, where 1 rad of gamma gives you the equivalent biological damage of 1 rem. So alpha is 20 times more damaging than the gamma radiation. Okay. So that's how we do the measurements from a dose standpoint and the equivalent of biological damage to your body. And if you're a radiation worker, you're generally going to have a TLD badge, which is a thermoluminescence dosimeter, something that is going to actually measure the amount of radiation dose that your body receives, and then they'll process that. That's usually going to be recorded in some unit of REM. It could be millirem or microrem or REM itself, but some portion of REM from any type of radiation that you may have been exposed to or received. Okay, let's move on so we can conserve some time here. Radiation subunits, again, just like the Curie, we can take that REM or the Rankine and break it down to millis and micros and picos and nanos, things like that. Okay, slide number 79. Let's talk about some of the guidelines for exposure control. US EPA and their Safety, Health, and Environmental Management Program, guide number 38, their Radiation Safety and Health Protection Program. And this is where you can find the exposure guidelines for people that are EPA employees. EPA has an administrative control level of 500 millirem per year. That used to be the old limit for the general public. Now, the newer limit for the general public is 100 millirem, just to let you know. But if you're enrolled in the program, in any 12 consecutive months, you should not exceed 500 millirem, is what that means. Okay. They also have, in the next slide here, 81, excuse me, I got a little bit ahead of myself. This is just a continuation of the administrative control level. You can get waivers or exceptions to that for critical work, emergency response type work, planned special events, and life-saving activities. Okay, this is mentioned in SHMP Guide 38, and you can see another reference down there, US EPA 400-RS9201. That's the Manual of Protective Action Guides for radiological incidents. So this is where some of these numbers come from also. And here's the one that I got ahead of myself, which is an action reference level. So every quarter, they exchange out their dosimeter, and it's measured. Okay? And they also have a quarterly limit of 50 millirem per quarter. So you've got 500 per year, but you've also got 50 per quarter. And basically, what this is like an early warning to say, hey, well, you really shouldn't be getting this. Let's pull you out from working in radiation for a while, and let's investigate and see what's going on. Okay? And pretty much limits are counted that way there. A lot of organizations will have an administrative limit that would be much more conservative to the legal limit to make sure they don't go over any legal limits. They go over their administrative limit or get close to administrative limit, they can do an internal investigation. Once you break an actual legal limit, now you've got OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, to deal with. All right, next slide, 83, monitoring dosimetries. We'll talk a little bit about dosimeters required for US EPA work. Thermoluminescence dosimeter. Monitor the external exposure, wear for one calendar quarter, then you exchange it and get a number, and so on. So if you're an EPA person working around radiation greater than background, you should be enrolled in the program and you should have a dosimeter to monitor your exposure. Moving on to 84, slide 84, monitoring the dosimeter devices. There are additional dosimeters. Generally speaking, your TOD badge is a whole body dissimilar that you put on the upper torso of your body and you wear it around. If you're doing hot work with your hands and arms or other type of situations, you may have a different type of dosimeter. So they have them like finger ring dosimeters, ankle dosimeters, neutron dosimeters if you're working around that, accident dosimeters. And they also have dosimeters now, the electronic dosimeters. And EPA has those also. They can actually show you a dose right, and you can set alarm levels to that to give you an early warning. Okay, slide 85. One of the things that came out in the revision to SHIP Guide 38 were emergency exposure guidance or turn back levels. These are levels here, and you can see them on the visual here, doing different phases of work, early phase of an emergency, intermediate phase, or late phase, and the radiation exposure rates, you can see in the middle there, that's associated with stop what you're doing and back off and turn back and get some more guidance before you go any further. And you can see those numbers there without me going through. Protective action guides come down in that document that's referenced here at the bottom. It was pretty much put out by the EPA to help public officials make decisions. During a radiological emergency, these health divisions and public officials must act quickly to protect the public. So EPA developed these PAGs to help them in making critical decisions. They don't make the decisions for these officials. They have to make them. They just give recommendations. And slide 87 to that, 10 rem to save equipment, 25 rem to save personnel, and if it's greater than 25 rem, you use volunteers on it. In other words, it's something you have to volunteer for. And slide 88, identifies these three phases. Slide 89, in the early phase, this is several hours a day, you're worried about evacuation and sheltering. Are you going to evacuate the people or are you going to shelter them in place? Usually turn off the ventilation, close the windows, things like that. Getting into the intermediate phase, which is weeks to months, now our protective actions are moving towards things like limiting food and water consumption, making sure that people minimize the amount of radioactive material, say, that they may ingest. Okay? And then you get into the late phase, which gets into more the decontamination phase of property and things like that. So these are all part of the protection active guides that you can find in that document that's referenced on the slide there. Now, slide 92. Some of the legal limits, OSHA's legal limits. You can find them codified in 29 CFR 1910.1096, and you can see the limits there. They have quarterly whole body head and trunk, restricted to 1.25 rem per quarter, which pretty much gives you 5 rem a year limit. And then you can see they have different ones for your extremities. Next one is NRC, which is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's codified in 10 CFR 20. And NRC, they're pretty much the main organization when it comes to radiation safety and radiation control, Nuclear Regulatory Commission. A lot of people use their recommendations, their standards, or their legal limits, and adapt them into their own procedures and standards and regulations. But they're pretty much 5 rem a year. And Appendix B provides for annual limits of intake. This is pretty much from an ingestion standpoint, which is still based on that 5 rem a year. Okay? And it's also based on, just for information, a 2,000-hour work week, and they can come up with what they call derived air concentration hours, or DAC hours, which are airborne radioactivity limits that you can be in without poisoning areas of radioactive airborne area or require respirators. Kind of gets back into the inhalation ingestion question a little bit ago. Okay, slide 94. Pregnant worker has to be declared. SHIP Guide 38 addresses this. You know, I see anybody going to address this to have women work in radiation. The worker may voluntarily announce that she's pregnant, and in which case her radiation exposure has to be limited to 500 millirem during the gestation period. Okay, she can revoke that in writing whenever she wants. And she doesn't have to let the employer know if she doesn't want, but it would probably behoove her to let the employer know. So we can help with, minimize exposure to the future newborn. Okay, allow her. As long as we can be achievable, we talked about kind of in the beginning, time distance and shielding. Your radiation exposure is a function of time distance and shielding. So you spend less time there, you get less exposure, consequently you get less dose. Increase your distance away from a source, it decreases the intensity of the radiation coming from that source, so it decreases your exposure and consequently your dose. And then shielding, which is something you put between you and the source to give the radiation energy something else to interact with so that less of that energy comes out on the other side of where you are, consequently reducing your exposure and your dose. Okay, slide 96, let's get into biological effects real quick, and then we'll end this thing. More is known now about this, you know, been a lot of studies now for biological effects of radiation. You can see some of the major groups in there that we studied, you know, radiological workers, which we still have, therapy patients, atomic bomb survivors, and so on. Slide 98, some of the acute effects of radiation. Acute effects mean received over a short period of time. And you can see that 500 rads, we got ED low, effective dose low. You may see changes in the blood serum and things like that. And then as you go up, you can see the kind of effects that you may have there. TD stands for toxic dose. LD stands for lethal dose. So you can see when you get up around 450 rads, this is acute exposure in a short period of time. You know, like right now, you have what you call a LD 50, a lethal dose 50. Within 30 days. What that means is 50% of the people exposed, the population exposed, is expected to die within 30 days without any medical help or any intervention. Okay. Okay, chronic exposure. Small amount of exposure or radiation exposure or dose over a longer period of time. This is more for occupational workers, people that work in the radiation field for 20 or 30 years, and they get a little bit of radiation over a long period of time, okay? And the longer period of time you have the exposure, the better chance your body has of repairing itself. Okay, slide 100. Effects of chronic. Any member in the United States has about a 33% chance of contracting cancer, and of that 33%, about 25% of those have a chance of dying. Well, the cancer risk from radiation exposure, you can see, is increased 0.02% per rem. So if you have 50 rem, your increased risk of cancer will be about 1%. 0.02 times 50 is 1%. Damage mechanisms to living tissues. You can see that they can produce free radicals, break chemical bonds, damage molecules. This is the energy being transferred to the cells and causing damage, the radiation energy. And in slide 102, we can see the possible effects of that. The cell may not be damaged at all. Fine. The cells may be damaged but can repair themselves at lower levels. Fine. Cell may be damaged and operate abnormally. Not a good thing. Cell deaths may result in higher doses. Not necessarily a good thing, but we have cells dying in our body all the time, okay? The ones that third one, their cells may be damaged and operate abnormally, you know, mutations, and those are the ones that can probably cause the biggest problems. And then you get cells in your body not doing the things they're supposed to be doing. Okay, 103, cell sensitivity. They're the list of most radiosensitive cells, which are actively dividing in non-specialized cells. They're more susceptible to damage from ionizing radiation. Slide 104 shows the ones that are least radiosensitive, least susceptible to damage from ionizing radiation. You can see those. All right, now the effects, we have somatic effects. As you can see, they're damage to cells other than reproductive cells, so they're seen in the exposed individuals. You know, cataracts, things like that, cancer, whatever. But anyway, it's not passed on to the offspring. Those are somatic effects. And in slide 106, you can see you can have delayed somatic effects from chronic exposure. Cancer, cataracts, shorter life expectancy, so on. Slide 107, genetic effects. These are effects that are transferred onto the offspring. Mutations due to radiation damage due damage to the DNA of a cell. Now you're passing on, you know, if you have radiation damage to the DNA and you're passing that on to your offspring, you know, that could cause some problems. So you can have genetic damage passed on. And you can look at the bomb from all the atomic bomb survivors, you can see there's no heritable effects found in the children. Now there were somatic effects obviously found in the people that were exposed, but none of that seemed to be passed on as genetic effects. Slide 108. Here's some sources of radiation exposure and information. This website with the EPA. You go to that radiation website and you can find out a lot of things about radiation, put it that way. So that's why that's in here. Slide 109. The average annual dose. Because of these studies I've been talking about, in 2009, the NCRP came out with a new report. And the average annual dose to the general population now is about 625 milligrams per year for non-smokers. And that's just for living and doing the things you do. It used to be about 360 milligrams a year, but now it's gone up. Okay? And in slide 110, you can kind of see a breakdown of that from natural radiation. You can see the percentages, amount of percentage of the total of the radiation exposure. Obviously, it will all add up to 100%. But you can see the different percentage of the total. And you can see the amount in milligram per year from each one of those. From natural radiation, internal inhalation, radon, thoron, external from space, from cosmic sources, internal from ingestion, the things we eat, the things we breathe, external, terrestrial, the earth crust, things that make up the earth. All those add up to about 111 milligrams per year, which gives you about 50% of your total. The next slide, 111, are man-made sources. And you can see now that the medical industry is, because of CT scans and things like that, has started to increase our overall annual exposure that's expected just to the general population. So anyway, you add all these numbers up for total man-made, and you can see the percentage. And then slide 12, 112 puts it all together for you, total of natural and then total of man-made. It all comes up to right about 625 millirem a year now. Okay. Slide 113 gives you the sources of the radiation. We talked about those percentages and where they came from. This is just a pie chart cutout. It gives you a little bit better example of where the radiation comes from and what the percentages are. Okay? So you can see that because of computed tomography or CT scans, it gives you about 24% from the medical there. Radon and thoron, which is in the top right there, is still, you know, still pretty much topping the charts for the most part. But if you took the whole medical industry with x-rays and everything else, that pretty much tops the charts right now. But that's just an example of patch I cut out of percentages. And the last slide before we do the final questions is associated health risks based on industry and other things. You can see the health risks to the left and then estimated life expectancy loss to the right. So you can see the people that smoke 20 cigarettes a day can expect to lose 6 years off their life. If you're overweight by 15%, 2 years. If you drink alcohol, 1 year. So, you know, if you're an overweight smoker that likes to drink, you're probably not in good shape. And then you got all accidents. But the main thing here is you look at the occupational dose of one rim for the ages of 8 to 65 and then occupational doses of, you know, falling from one rim to one for 300 millirem, and you can see the life expectancy loss there, which is, you know, fairly low comparatively. And you can even see the source of information there if you wanted to look that up yourself. And having said that, that brings us to the end of our overall presentation. So, Michael, any questions?
Yeah, I'd like to point out before we start doing questions and before everybody starts to leave, slide 116 is our final slide, and it has a link to the feedback form. And again, the feedback form, if you want to fill that out for us, after you fill out the feedback form, there's a little thing that you can print out, and it's sort of useful to show that you attended today's seminar, if you require that. Right now I don't have a whole lot of questions. I did have a sort of a logistical question, because I know that we don't have a whole lot of additional resources. We don't have a whole lot underneath that section right now for this seminar. But someone asked about the instructor's notes for the slides, because they don't have any. Is it possible that we could post those?
Well, I guess I could if I generated them. I didn't. Oh. A lot of my talk is just on basic notes and reference material that I have, and having about 30 years of experience in the field right now.
I guess the answer maybe to that is we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, and maybe even a better answer. I mean, I'm sure they probably want something they can put in their library or whatever, but everybody should have my contact information. So if they wanted to know anything specifically about any particular slide or lecture, whatever, they can always contact me or give me a call, and I can talk to them about it, and then they can start forming their own notes if they want to. And one of the reasons I say that, the notes on there are pretty much, you know, it's not a textbook type thing, because some of the opinions differ in the world of radiation. Some things are absolute. But a lot of the information is just generic information from several different sources. I'll give you an example. We didn't talk about this, but there's this thing called hormesis. Maybe some of you have heard of it, maybe not. And there's actually some people that think that a little bit of radiation is good for you, and then there's some people that think it's not. Hormesis has to do with, you know, certain substances, toxins, whatever that they make. At small doses may actually have some beneficial properties to you. The thing about radiation is you've got one theory where there's a no threshold type of assessment, and then you've got one that is a threshold. Some people believe you have to get up to a certain number in order to start seeing any adverse effects from radiation. Some people believe there is no threshold, so it's any number. And that's why quite often you hear, well, any amount of radiation may be harmful to your health. The key word there is may. So some of this stuff depends. Some of the instructor notes, to be honest with you, some of these slides could get fairly lengthy if you really wanted them to be. But if they contact me or whatever, I'll try to give them some reference materials or at least give them some information they can write their own notes. And I can get around to putting notes on all these eventually, but I don't know when that's going to be and how they would get a hold of it.
Well, that's fine. I think what we can do at the very least is put up some of the resources that you have some listed in the on the slides, and we can put some quick links to them in the resources section.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have a question that did come in, and I don't remember you discussing this, but you must have for it to come up. Can you describe secular equilibrium?
No, I didn't talk about that. I could, but that gets more into the quantum physics type of stuff, which is a little bit outside the realm of what we wanted to do here, which is basic radiation principles.
Okay.
It would get a little lengthy. And we're running out of time. They can email me if they like. Oh, you know what? Some of these things you can Google, or you can look it up. You can look that up yourself if you really wanted to learn about it.
Okay. Are there any questions from people attending on the phone lines if you want to ask them? Right now, you can hit #6 to unmute your phone if you want. And while we're waiting, secular equilibrium is a situation in which the quantity of a radioactive isotope remains constant because its production rate is equal to its decay rate. In other words, the decay of the parent isotope is equal to its decay rate. And so that's as simple as what, if you have questions, simple as a quick Google definition.
Yeah, that would be the quick definition.
Yeah.
Well, I currently do not have any other questions that have come in.
Like people want to go home.
Yeah. So if there are no other questions, I'd like to thank the participant for attending today, and I'd like to thank Guy for his knowledge and his presentation today. And I guess right now I will formally end the seminar. Don't forget slide 116. There's a link to the feedback form, and we should have the archive of this seminar in about 2 weeks. Thanks, everybody, for attending.